in the apartment?
Good. The Yeshivat Har-Tzion is shut. A number of too many people had COVID, this new strain, and so they just sent us all home.
Wow. All right. So tight.
I'll be making tonight. We'll be making black lentil and sausage soup.
It's great. I wish we could all participate.
Yeah, sometime we should cook together. It's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. I'm down. We could have a chabura cook-off.
Yeah. We're almost there. I don't mean with Yored. I mean, like, we're almost done. Like, tomorrow. It's this time, roughly.
Unbelievable. Shomer, you're saying being done with Sugya?
Inauguration.
Oh, this era.
The other Sugya. Yeah. Dory, my stepbrother, is a couple blocks from the Capitol. He says it's like, it feels like, you know, under occupation.
It's interesting. Yeah. Does she make like a Baruch Shep Tarani or?
I don't know. I don't usually watch the inauguration because it's like a boring, sickening, demagogic affair, but probably will this year. I mean, it'll still be boring, but
apparently SAR, like, we're pausing class to watch it. Apparently they do that every for every new, like, not a re-election, but they did it in 2016 and then 2008. Like, they, like, all of class stops and each 12:30 class watches the inauguration.
Wow.
It's like, seems like excessive. Like, I don't remember watching any inaugurations when I was younger.
The peaceful transfer of power is one of the great miracles in human history. You should stop class. That is appropriate to stop class.
Yeah, maybe we should have a group watching tomorrow. Be fine. All right.
I mean, it's not the State of the Union. The State of the Union, should not be televised. It shouldn't be spoken. I don't know who was it who started the tradition of giving the State of the Union as a speech. For the first, like, 100 years of the Republic, it was just submitted in writing. And now it's just like a fan. It's just political fanfare. It's kind of gross. Anyway.
All right. With that introduction, we delve into Yored here. So we come to our last part of the Yored discussion here. Gabe said he has a conflict today, so we might have to hold off on the Parat piece for Gabe. Did everyone read the Parat piece? Who had a chance to?
I don't know what piece you're talking about.
Okay, I emailed it out, Cole, right? I think I emailed it out. Zachariah, I emailed it?
Yeah, I just typed Parat into my Gmail, and it just came up. That was, like, a good way of finding it.
But it was an email that I sent, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I could resend it out. But I thought it was a very nice piece. We'll talk about it a little later, but I thought it was a very nice piece, no?
Can we have a reading guide for it, as it's like 45 pages long?
Shu is not here, but, you know, it's a law review. You just have to, like, find the important parts. But we'll talk about the important parts. Zacharia and Noah, did you guys like it? Did you find it insightful? And all right, well.
Yeah, we got to the first two sections, but, like, those are, like, the central ones on your read.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's interesting that he tries to connect it with the sugyas of Zachin and the sugya of Mitzias Chaveiro, which we could talk about when we look at the piece inside. But let's wrap up the sugya first. So what I want to talk about today is all the cases where the Baal HaBayis wants to... I want to talk about the Baal HaBayis' defense that he didn't receive any hana, lo nichalei klal, lo nene. So it's true that maybe on the objective market or in fair market value or something like that, the Yored did make an improvement. But at least given the Baal HaBayis' subjective preferences, he has a legitimate claim that he received no benefit from the Yored service. Now, I think that's a very important part of the sugya, because that again puts the power back into the Baal HaBayis' hand to defeat the Yored's claim for a compensation. So if the Baal HaBayis could issue this defense of lo nichali, lo nanesi, that's a very important component to the for the Sigyo. So we have here our first Makari. So I want to refresh your memory of the Balamor in our Sigyo and Kefalith. The Balamor here opposed the reing of the Rif and the Misifta. And he said, the Rif and the Misifta argue that the Balabayas can always say, Tol Eitzcha Vavonecha, right? Or at least in a Sadeshe. Yeah, they thought that in general, the Balabayas could say, take back the benefit. But the Balamor didn't like that. The Balamor said, in general, Ein Shomim Lo. The Balabayas cannot force the Yore to undo the improvements. We discussed this earlier, why not? But he concedes here at the end, Vadai Hecha Dehave Ahu Binyan Shelo Keroi Labalakarka, the Lesle Beishum Hana. If you know, there's no Hana to the Balakarka. You know, for example, this guy built a residential tower when the Balakarka wanted a commercial tower. Dili Dei Mitzbai Le Lemivne Dilavka Ahu Binyana. You know, the Balabayas was going to build something different. Here it sounds like he's saying, look, if there's mamish no benefit that the Balabayas receives, then he could force the Yoreid to undo the improvement. So what I think is interesting here is that the Balamor is distinguishing between two cases. In a case where the Bala Sadeh acknowledges that he received some hana, he just doesn't want to pay for it, he's chayiv to pay. So you trespass, you put these roses in my front lawn, and I can see that my lawn looks better with the roses, right? I say, it looks great. Just, you know, I don't want to pay for it because I didn't request it. There I'm chayiv to pay you. But if I make the argument that like, oh no, like your roses, they ruined the design that I had for my garden. It was supposed to be a hydrangea garden and you know, you put in these hideous roses, then I could say, Tol Eitzcha Vavonecha, but I could compel the Yoreid to reverse the benefit. So the Balamor has the kernel of this idea that the power resides in the Balabayas, at least in a case where it's lo nene klal, right? That's his formulation. Les lebe shumhana, that he could force the undoing of the benefit. Adin, you have a hand?
Yeah, I'm not like... I think it could have ramifications in terms of how we like or like frame these things, like frame the two options of how we're are we translating shum hana'a as monetary benefit, aesthetic benefit, because like there's if it's defined by like it could be that the roses look nice but provide no actual monetary or property value type of benefit, then maybe. That play, and if the Baal Bayis could still say Tol Eitzcha Vavonecha, that would like frame the discussion as one of your ability to veto or not an actual tangible economic benefit. Whereas if it's purely aesthetic or something like that, that puts it more in the Yoreid's like a turf in terms of like it needs to be a literal negative or something like that, or an absolute zero. In terms of defining who gets like the upper hand here.
Yeah, his formulation is very strong. Is less be right, less lay be shum hana, hala mahani le below midi. Those phrases sound very absolute just from the language. Looks like Noah wants to respond to this. Noah, you have a hand on this?
Yeah, I thought it was I haven't looked at it for a while, but like I thought it was interesting how the sort of he does say less lay be shum hana. He's also like the example that he brings isn't an example of nohana. It's an example of dilidide misbai le mivnie dilav kehahu binyana. It's sort of like, you know, it could still be totally useful, like, you know, let's say like building a gas station where you wanted to build a residential tower. Like, you know, it could still be like some hana, but it's not, you know, that's why the Balamor is a little bit confusing.
You're saying there's asymmetry between when he says less based shamana,
yeah,
that versus saying if you know I had other plans for the karka. It's a good point. I think it's a good way of capturing the tension.
I mean, I think the first phrase of the Balamor sort of gets to that point though, in this idea of avada hechada hade hahu binyan shelo karoi lebal hakarka. It's not roi to this guy,
Yeah.
So it seems to make it a little more subjective in that sense. Like, yeah, it's a house. You build a new house on the property, of course, it has a value, but you just don't want it there.
Right.
But like, when you describe that, you know, when you describe that as less lepe shumhana, then, like, I'm not, you know, I don't know.
Right. Like, let's say I acknowledge that there's an improvement. It's just not the kind of improvement that I wanted to make. You know, there's like those kinds of interesting cases. So yeah. What happens in that case?
I mean, it's sort of like it's an improvement that's useless to you. It's like you built a swimming pool on property, like, okay, the property is now more valuable, but like, I don't swim.
Right. yeah, those are the interesting questions, exactly. Balamar's a little cryptic on where he stands on that.
Yeah, like I'm just looking ahead to the Chazon Ish uses Shevach versus Hana. Like Shevach at least like strikes me as a more monetarily defined.
Okay, good, yeah. Let's look at the Chazon Ish here. I thought this was interesting. Chazon Ish, he says, I mean, just a little background what the Chazon Ish is worried about. He's worried about how you have to pay the Poel. And on one interpretation, you might have to pay the Poel in Kesef. Right? This assuming that assuming the Yored is like a Poel, you might have to pay the Yored with Kesef, not Shavit Kesef. This ring a bell, I think we discussed this on Thursday, right? The special Poel rule. Now, the Chazon Ish says that's crazy. If the Baal HaBayis is not liquid, then he's going to have to sell his karka to pay off a benefit that he didn't want in the first place. That just seems draconian. So the Chazon Ish here basically makes an argument along the Baal HaMor's lines. He says, B'mistalik min ha-shevach, yesh lepotra min ha-hatzah. If the Baal HaBayis, you know, renounces the shevach, he could be exempt from paying the yored altogether. Mitam dinechshav ke'en kan shevacha klal. So again, very important formulation. If it's lo nichale b'hai shvacha, it's as if there's no shevach, which I think is important for capturing the distinction between, you know, an improvement in market value, but a no improvement, a lo nichale, given the subjective preference of the balakarka. Right, so on Zillow, the price of the house goes up because of the new landscaping, but the Baal HaKarka is, you know, not interested. He likes living in a dump or something like that. Right, so there it sounds like the Chazon Ish is acknowledging that lo nichale b'hai shvacha is tantamount to nechshav ke'en kan shvacha klal. Now he says here, this is also interesting. So imagine that you had to pay the guy with kesef. Im ein lo lebaylim kesef, ichayev limkor chelak misadehu l'shalim lahem. Do you have to sell off part of your real property to make good on your obligation to the yored? And he says, v'lechora laksa midas hadin, sheyadim yored l'stei chaveru bal karcho, v'yigrom lo hechrach limkor sadehu. Now that I read this line again, it strikes me as a really fascinating. You know, one of the recurring themes that we've been encountering is the question of property rights. Like, what rights to exclude does the Baal HaKarka have against a trespasser? How much control and sovereignty does he have over his karka? And this is part of the issue with the Issi in the Achilas Poelim discussion. Notice here, the Chazon Ish seems to be saying that it's like it would undermine somebody's property right, laksa midas hadin, or be inequitable, that somebody could come into your karka and force you to have to sell it. It's kind of fat, you know, in the Zen Nen of Azelo Chaser Sugyas, it's interesting that, you know, is that also laksa midas hadin, that a guy could just inhabit your property without having to pay rent? But the Chazon Ish thinks there's something, maybe this gets back to Cole's point from last week about, you know, the irony about the Yored being the cause of your loss to the Karka, right? The guy who was Yored to be Mashbiach now forces you to lose like that thing itself. So the Chazon Ish says, look at this. V'harei ein kan shevach klau, d'tvei nichalei l'baal HaBayis shelo yita v'shelo yitzdarech limkor. When you net the benefits, right, or you sum the benefits and losses, The Bala Bias is at a net loss if he would rather hold on to his Karka than have the improvement of the Yore rate, right? So if holding on to the land is more valuable to you than having the equivalent of the land in cash, then you receive no Shevach by the Yore's improvement if you have to, were you to have to sell and compensate him. See, I think that's really important because you could generalize the Chazanish's argument and say, that's also true for having to pay for a service. If there's a kind of service that undoubtedly improves the value of the karka, just you're cheap, right? You don't like spending money on these things. So you yourself wouldn't have spent the cash on the service, then you're at a net loss if you have to pay the Yore's improvement. So I'll give you an example, and then I'll take the hands. If you're like me, so then you're more than happy to pay somebody to shovel the snow than do it yourself. Right? Like I'll outsource any service that I can, unless I enjoy doing it. But there are other people who they just like the thought of having to pay somebody for a service they can do, just it's abhorrent. It sounds like you're frittering away money to pay for something that could be done yourself. Now, it sounds like the Chazon Ish is saying, if you're the latter type of person, then even though we all recognize you benefited from the shoveling, since you would have rather done it yourself overpaying somebody, you're at a net benefit loss, right? You're in the net negative. And so it's ki'ilu ein kan shevach klal. I think that's what you get from this argument. Ein kan shevach klal, detrei nichle lebala bayis, you know, in my case, shelo l'shalem avur ha'pula. You know, that's I think that's what you can get from his argument. Okay. And he says, of course, the dayan should have to assess that, which I think makes a lot of sense. Nira dima dayan roa delo nichle b'hai shevacha, which I think is pretty sensible. Okay, so let's take the hands. We have Adin and then Adam.
So I think my initial reading is that you're way overstating the fact that Chazon Ish has to like get it from this case, which is like such an extreme like version of potential loss to the Baal HaBayit. Like I think he's saying, because it's not like he's saying, oh, you didn't want it, so therefore there's no shavach. It's saying that this is just a regular case of ein shavach klal, because when you add up it's only like it's where like literally you have to be forced to sell it, and we look at it as okay, then there you can't call it shavach if my ledger is like it's better for me to have property than to have like the I don't know economics at all, but like. But the value of the property is like more. It is better equity than the cash on hand. But because what you've sent, like your reading is essentially doing, is like removing the teeth from the entire sugya of Yored. Like,
well, no. Let me address both of those points. I think the first point you're saying is, why does the Chazon Ish talk about this really strict case of being forced to sell your karka if you could have made the equivalent points? You know, in my case, right, I'd rather not pay cash for the service.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's your argument, the first part of your argument, right, Adin?
Yeah, I think that like because I think he's reading it as like, I when we first heard that line, Lakta Midas Adin, it's like, is he saying like, oh, it's inconceivable that your property right would be this week or something like that? But I think he said, like, I think the fact that the way he, in the underlying section, are there, like, no, it's like your property right, we're not changing our understanding of the property right, it's just this specific case, we added up it and the sum is ein shavach klal, so therefore no need to pay. Not like this is some unique based on our understanding of property right, it can't lead to this conclusion. Like we see when we do all the math in this specific case, we say okay, this equals no shavach.
But couldn't that, when, so let's say you sum up the hana, you sum up the, you know, the utils, the hana benefits in my case also, right? So I'd rather, if I have to fork out cash for the service, I'm in a negative 10. Having my walk shoveled gives me a plus 9. You sum the totals, I'm at a negative 1.
I think you could say that
it's the same.
between having to set, like, clearly the benefit, you can't argue there's benefit to the property if I have less property at the end of the day. And maybe this comes back to our old discussion of like service versus like tangible. And maybe you argue there's a distinction there.
Right. See the way I would motivate your position is to say there's something special about real property, you know, that a yield shouldn't be able to force you to sell off your real property. Right. That's the, as opposed to like, oh, having to pay a little extra cash, that's not really a big deal. But if the Chazanish's underlying point is about the, if you're in a net negative, then it's ki'ilu ein kan shvacha klal, then I think you could generalize it to my case quite easily.
Yeah, but then you're placing the entire sugya of Yored in the eyes of the subjective eyes of the Baal HaBayit, which is feasible, but that's a vast reorganization of the sugya, I think.
Well, it's not a vast reorganization of the sugya. It only what it does is it says the Yorid compensation is due only if the Baal HaBayit is in a net positive. Right? He's in a net positive of Hana from the service.
But determined not by the real cash value of the service or improvement, but by the Baal HaBayit's presumed like Dayan educated like value of the improvement.
Correct. That's right. Meaning we're going to define Hana subjectively rather than on the fair market value of the property. That's right.
Okay.
Which I think is so crazy.
I don't think the Chazanish wants to like subjectivize the whole thing. He's talking about a pretty narrow case where just the comping for the improvements would put the Baal HaBayit in the red.
That's true.
I the Chazanish is talking about the absurd thing that, you know, I think the way you started, you introduced it was correct, that, you know, it would be kind of ridiculous if the parade could put this guy into bankruptcy. It would be like, you know, layers of irony if the Yored could put the Baal HaBayit into bankruptcy by you know, forcing improvement on him. And so, you know, the that's absurd. You know, that is itself, as you say, a kind of, you know, causing of a look. The din of Yored can cause can also be the cause of the loss, and so we don't want to build in a kind of self-defeating mechanism. I don't think, right, though, that what Adin is saying follows. Like, there are many cases where it's a small set. I mean, there's a sense in which Adin's correct. Most cases are going to be either where the Baal HaBayit want the improvements or where he tells the guy to take his stuff and shove off. The set of cases where like Yado Ala Taktona is going to be pretty small. But because the number of things that you can do to like shift the improvements into Yado Ala Yona is so large. But it's still like, you know, that doesn't mean that it won't exist, which is to say that the objective improvement of the thing, even in a case where the you know, the Baal HaBayit doesn't want it, and when it, you know, the field, you know, wasn't kind of apt for it, that set of cases will still conceptually at least exist.
Yeah, we're gonna see more formulations along these lines, but I think this is exactly what the Rishonim are gonna be struggling with here, about the subjective benefits versus the objective, you know, shevach in the karka and the fair market value increase, things like that. Yeah. Let's just take Adam out of hand, and then let's take Zachariah and Noah's hand. Unless, Adam, is your comment separate from the Adin discussion, and then we should get Zachariah and Noah in on this?
It's on the Adin discussion.
Great.
So I'll make two points, one towards the objective side, one towards the subjective side. On the objective point of this, you also have to calculate the liquidation costs, which are rather significant. Like, if you sell $1 million house, you're not getting $1 million, you're getting $900,000.
Yeah. That's right. Aren't explicit about these things. That's a really, you know, obviously important point. Like, the transaction costs cut into the.
Right. I mean, paying for something in cash is always cheaper than paying for it by having to sell an asset.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Another aspect of it is there's also sort of this, it's a little subjective, a little objective, but the endowment aspect of it. Like, there was a concept in economics of endowment. When you have something, it's worth more to you than if someone were to pay you the actual fair market value for it, in general.
Right.
Right, and theoretically, right, that has significant effects when it comes to land, because theoretically, one piece of land is not, I can't say, well, give me this acre, I'll give you a different acre of the same value. This one's already next to you. That endowment aspect, you already worked on this land, it's already right there. It's convenience to you. That yeah. also increases the value to it.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a really interesting point. Somebody should write a paper on, you know, all these like recent like behavioral economics stuff, and like try to see like where like the halacha, you know, either incorporates or doesn't incorporate them.
Somebody was looking to put something about that last year on Lair House.
Yeah, that's right. On Mishaling B'Idis, right?
Idis and Shavu Kesef.
Yeah, but it, you know, it extends well beyond that. So yeah, I mean, it would be interesting just to like look for all the cases where it's relevant. I'll give you an example. I wrote up this piece over the summer talking about Poel Batel. Poel Batel was part of the discussion. So Rashi has two formulations about Poel Batel. One of them is, so you know what a Poel Batel is? Are you familiar with this? It's like when you get compensated for not working, like if you the breach of contract case, you don't get the full value of your contract. You get a little less because the hana you receive from not having to work. That, anybody familiar? We discussed this last year in the Chabura. But so there are two formulations in Rashi. And one Rashi says you calculate it based off how much you would pay, how much you would pay to get vacation time. Right? So it's like, how much would you pay to not have to show up to work today? You get your full salary, you get your salary, but then you pay back some to not show up to work. A different formulation of Rashi says, how much less would you be willing to accept in your salary to not have to show up to work? So in classical economics, right, those would be the same, right? Because right, it's just a question of like, what's the price difference that how, like you rationally, you should be willing to pay the same amount that you'd be willing to deduct from your salary to get the vacation. But like, as like you're pointing out, Adam, right? Some people have already, psychologically, people are more willing to receive less than to have to pay more. Right. Right, Adam? So I wrote this up, and somebody I was working with said like, oh, you know, those two values come apart sometimes. You know, it's an interesting point. All right, fine. Let's see. Zacharia and then Noah.
Yeah, so two points. Well, one, just on the thing you mentioned about the Poel Batel, like in the Tsar Sugya in Achovel, this comes up really powerfully, as in the difference between how much would you pay to get this Tsar, or how much would you pay to avoid this Tsar? I think that's actually like a very psychologically perceptive Sugya. But anyway.
Yeah, that's another example. Yeah, somebody... Somebody wants to write this up. Let's put our heads together and let's...
Low-hanging fruit. Onto Adin's point, where you kind of framed that, oh, this idea of like the subject, super subjective hana is a little out there, or at least, you know, chudash. I think it's actually very natural to these sugyas. In the Zen Nehne Zelo Chaser, the definition of Nehne is actually really unique. It's not like the Chalavim Va'arayos Nehne. It's Gavra Avilamegar. So just for context, if Noah has a empty apartment and he's not renting out, and I'm homeless and I would need to pay, I don't know, $100 to buy a rent a hotel room, and then I go sleep in his apartment for free. So that's Nehene Zelo Chaser, because we say I'm Kster Nehene because I avoided paying $100. However, if I have my own apartment that I could have slept in, and then I went to Noah's apartment, I'm not considered a nehene in that framework at all. Even though I've gained the warmth of his blanket and the comfort of his bed, that's not considered a hana whatsoever. No one thinks you should pay. So I think it's just a very natural import to the yored of say, oh, a nehene is someone who, you know, well, would he have done this anyway, otherwise?
Yeah, would he have done it on his own? Yeah, good. We're going to see that if you saw the discussion based off of Sugya and Ksuvis and Daf Pei about the Baal, who's an Aris, it comes up there, right? So let's say the Baal Akarka is an Aris, and he likes doing this, like the guy who likes to shovel, not just because he's cheap, because like, you know, he's like Achlushe de Mechuza, he likes working hard and things like that. That's exactly right. So we're going to see that come up in a few minutes. Great point.
Like, but doesn't does this formulation not make the entire category of like Sade Ha'asuyalita versus non Ha'asuyalita like in what circumstance would you have a Sade She'ina Asuyalita that there would ever be some sort of, if this is our definition of Hana'a, like there would never be, like presumably there would basically never be Hana'a in that case. Like I was like I wasn't gonna put a garden in this in I don't know, in my cave or something like that.
There could be a Hana in a case where you plant like out of crop rotation. So it could be a Suyalita, it could be like the term, it'd be like the, this year could be the grain year, but you plant the wheat year, but you plant strawberries or whatever. So there's Hana from the strawberries, but it's not a Suyalita. There could be cases where presumably this is discussed, where like the I'm sure there are poskim who talk about it, where like, you know, a Suyalita could mean, you know, any number of very narrow things, and Hana is just like, you know, what you could sell on the, you know, on the market. There's no question that you're benefiting, you're just not, but a Suyalita might be indexed to like, you know, foregone benefits or maximum possible benefits or maximum reasonably expectable benefits.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you could have a lot of cases where you know, it's acknowledged that you benefit, even if like you just didn't do it on your own. You know, that could happen. So for example, like one reason I should hire a landscaper for my front lawn. The reason why I don't is just because I'm too late. Like I'm literally too lazy to like start looking around and calling up a guy to do it. But if somebody were to find a landscaper and do it for me, it's a Sada Suyalita. It could use some nice landscaping. It's, you know, I don't know if that's...
But if our definition is the Baal HaBayit wouldn't have done it on his own, I guess you're saying that there might be a scenario of like, I really never would have done it.
I think it's more than just that you wouldn't have done it. It's that like you're at a net negative. It's like the reason why you didn't do it is because of your preferences. You're at a net negative.
Okay.
See that?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Noah, did you have a comment on this, or yours? How you got your comment in?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like a long, but I guess supporting your read of your expansion of the Chazon Ish in light of Cole's question. Is that sort of like, I don't know if there's like a magical distinction between like going into debt from having to sell off real property, like a distinction between that and like paying mizumin when like I have a finite amount of cash that I would need to use for other, I'm not the US Mint. I have a finite amount of cash that I would need to use for other, you know, purposes. Like, I'm not sure. I think it would be a little difficult to draw like a strong distinction between those two things.
I agree with that reading. I was going to say that Adin's reading is like fetishizing real property, you know, when really the underlying principle is just the net negative that you're being forced to go into.
What do you mean?
Mizumin is cash.
Mizuman.
Oh, I see. Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Oh. Mizumin is just available cash, right? Because it's mizuman. Yeah, it's
as opposed to cartis. Yes.
Oh, right. The distinction is just that the distinction, like in any case, you're netting out the same place. It would just be like insanely. It would be sort of against the spirit of the law if in order to compensate for improvements you didn't take on, you had to sell the thing that was improved. Like that's absurd.
You might say the improvement is to your net value. So your economics that are positive.
It's not to your net value.
You're gonna have to spend money to cultivate the field anyway. Like, you know, like fields don't cultivate themselves.
The case that Adish is talking about is one in which the, like, you know, let's say you have a field, it's worth 10. You have, or it doesn't matter how much the field is worth, but let's say the improvements made to the field are way beyond the current value of the field and also way beyond your liquid assets. So it's outrageous that in order to like get this guy, this Yoraid's Leon off your field, you have to sell the field. You didn't ask him to come. I mean, it's just putting you in a position where in order to enjoy the benefits of property, you have to sell the property that you're looking to enjoy the benefits of. That's just an outrageous consequence of the law. It does matter for the Chazon-ish that it's like this piece of property, the piece that was improved, that you would have to be selling off in order to compensate the Yoraid.
Right. I think that's the tension. I think that's the tension between mine and Noah's read and, you know, you're in a Kol Adin read. I see that tension for sure.
I just don't even understand like why Noah, other than that, you're going to have to pay cash anyway. I mean, let me put it this way. There's even a more basic point, which is that if this field, say, is your only asset, okay, you don't have any cash. That means, and the only possible thing you can do to pay off the Yoraid is to sell the field, then in fact, the Yoraid hasn't benefited you because you're worse off. So
I think that's exactly what I was saying. That I don't think the Chazon-ish makes like some ramification based.
Not a huge chiddush with the Chazon-ish.
Yeah, but I think Dafka, he's not saying kind of what Colt like. I think that like the tension, like the underlying tension, is there of like the like inconceivable ramifications of the approach of Yoraid. But I think he's making a very narrow point in terms of like this. We can't call this hana. Like we look at the ledger and say this is not hana. So therefore, there's no chiyuv to pay.
But my point is, you could say, right, there's no hana for like in the cash cases also, if there's a net negative. Listen, let's see how these other Rishonim come out on this. So you can see here the Meiri, who by the way is always eminently sensible in how he comments and interprets Gemaras. You know, he just throws in here.
Like a religion based primarily on the Meiri.
What do you say, Cole?
You would like a religion that's primarily based on the Meiri.
Meiri's great. The Meiri is he's my role model. I mean, the guy literally just sat in like Nowheresville, Provence, like had no sounds like he had no communal responsibilities. He wrote like one of the greatest treaties on halacha. I mean, he's the man, you know?
What was the name of the Meiri's treatise on halacha? You mean the Meiri, the Beis HaBechira?
Yeah, Beis HaBechira. I mean, it's an awesome work. I mean, it's in scope, it's probably greater than like what any other Rishon wrote. I mean, it's pretty.
Except the Ram.
And he was it's a different kind of work, you know. It's
I was just saving you from heresy.
Right. Sure. The next thing I was gonna say is the Meiri was also a good Aristotelian. You know, he always has like interesting he's one of the people who worried how the karka sits on top of the water if the element of water is lighter than... not too many people worry about those questions. The Meiri worries about it. All right, so the Meiri here writes, Hayabal asade o bala chotzer shasol o banai. So, you know, if the bala asade is a laborer or a worker, so kasu chachmei atzarfatim she'eno notel elamashehen neyu. So yeah, I think this is his way of saying, look, just calculate the marginal benefit that he receives by not having to do it on his own. The idea being that a shasal or banoi generally prefers to do it on his own. So just, you know, go and run the calculation of how much hana he got. V'chein yira, and here he injects like these further degrees of subjectivity. Meaning everything has to be evaluated based off like the circumstances, right? What kind of person is he? Is he the kind of guy who generally outsources his work? Does he have the resources to outsource his work? Right. So you have to do this case by case determination to just figure out what's the net benefit that the guy received. And that's going to be a function of his preferences in general. I think that's what the Meiri is getting at here, right? I mean, and he's basically saying, like, we don't just look to what's the increased value on the market. He says it all depends on Sipik Biyadu Laso Zakshav, Fimashe Huadam, how busy is he, what kind of guy, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Everybody on board with that reading the Meiri? I think it's pretty straightforward. All right. Next source is the Miuchas Leritva in Arsagya. What I found interesting here is, again, he talks about our Gemara's Galia Daite de Nichle, but then proceeds to talk about what happens if it's Galia Daite de Lo Nichle. So our Gemara said that if there's a Giloy Das that you like the improvement, as evidenced by you're making further improvements, you're building a fence around the new trees, etc., you pay Yadol Yona. But he says, I have a Bal HaKarka Aris, the Gadarla, Umintarla, the Galiyat of Nichale, Sarech Ian, if we're going to be Machayiv him to pay the full amount of Yadol HaYona, Odilma Kivan de Bal Aris, Lo Yayav Le Ela Hohutsa Shel Hanetios. Pretty interesting. So he seems to say like a similar idea to the Meiri. Even though normally if there's Giloy Das, you would have to pay Yadol HaElyona. If you're the kind of guy who would do the work on your own normally, does that save you from having to pay Yadol HaElyona? Because the subjective benefit that you get from this thing is less, given that you would normally do it on your own. Reasonable? I think that's very, very reasonable. Along the same lines as the Meiri. And then the Beis Yosef here, in where he paskins all the dinim of Yoreid, he cites the Gemara in Ksivis. Anybody want to tell us what's going on in that Gemara? Did anybody get a chance to check up Ksivis Daf Pei? Okay, so Zachariah, tell us about it.
Yeah, so the Mishnah there talks about when a wife owns some fields, the husband works the fields to some extent, and then they get divorced, what obligations does the wife have to the husband? So in that particular, the Mishnah says that if the husband worked the field and he was ochel some peiros, then after the divorce, the wife has no obligation to pay. If the husband worked the field and didn't ochel, then she pays hotzos.
Right. So it sounds like if the husband worked and benefited from it, it's all a wash.
Yeah.
Like he can't sue her after divorce for like the benefit that he conferred, right?
Right. And he can't say, can't like nickel and dime her for like the thing.
Exactly. I mean, like you worked, you benefited, like we'll assume that they offset each other or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Right. So then the Gemara brings a kind of a extension case of, let's say the husband hires sharecroppers or appoints sharecroppers on the wife's land, and they didn't yet get to the chance to eat yet. So do we view them in place of the Baal, in which case, you know, sorry, one second. No, excuse me. Maybe they did eat to some extent. And therefore, if you view them like the Baal, and therefore, once the divorce happens and the Baal is removed, therefore, all the Arisim lose all their claim to those cells. Or do you view them, no, as in, like, the woman would have, well, the language of the Gemara is, they're part of the land. But the Rashi explains, like, the wife would have hired them anyway, and therefore, their contract still stands, and they could get paid in full.
That's right. I mean, the question is, are they, like, subsumed under the Baal's privilege? And then if he loses his privilege, then they lose their entitlement?
Yeah.
Or is the idea that they have some independent claim to the, you know, the payros that they generated, like a regular aris? But then what's interesting, the Gemara asks, is what happens, or the Gemara talks about, what happens if the Baal is an aris himself, right? Chazinon Ibal arisu.
Yeah. So the Gemara establishes, he concludes there, that if the husband was an aris and he could have worked all the fields, in other words, that the wife could have had free labor during this time, then she doesn't owe the sharecroppers anything. Because exactly. He could say, I would have had a free laborer known as my husband.
Exactly. So this is like you look to the nearest possible world and see whether she would have paid for this benefit in that world. Right. So, so let's say her husband is a sharecropper, but he just subcontracted it out. Right. So then we say, look, in the nearby world. Sorry. Let me say this again. Let's say the husband's not a aris, but so he hires a resim to work the wife's fields. The idea is that even in a nearby world, the wife would have had to have paid directly for the aresim to work the field. So She's obligated to pay them for the service they provide. But if her husband is a artist, a worker himself, then in a nearby world, the husband would have done the work for her for free, right? In which case, she doesn't really benefit from the labors of the Arisim. Right? That's the Gemara's argument. So the Rishonim use this Gemara as evidence that, for the point that the Meiri raises, which is we look subjectively to say, given what the Baal HaBayis could have done on his own, did he benefit from the further work that the Yored contributed? Right? Good. So you can see actually a very nice formulation of this in the Ran in Ksuvis, which the Beis Yosef actually quotes, but you could see the Ran citing the Raiva here. Did anybody get a chance? I mean, it's in the Beis Yosef, but I'll just read it. I had this last moment. V'chasev ha-Raivid, dehu ha-din, le'inyan yored l'stei chavir shalo b'rshus, de'i bal karka arisu, eino no sein lo schar tircho, afilu b'sada ha-su yalita, ela demena tiosa. If the Baal is an artist, then he's never going to have to pay the going rate for the labor of the improvement, because the Baal would have done the labor himself. All he has to pay is for the materials that were used. Now, the Ran himself says, oh, maybe Efshar she'omdim kama yirtze litain shalo yiga lachbor v'lin toa. Mezeh dasa rashba. This is like an opportunity, like a reverse opportunity cost argument, right? Well, you know, if he was able to do a job somewhere else while this guy was working his field, so he recovers some benefit by having the leisure time, then he has to pay that amount to the poel, right? But what these discussions highlight is the move towards the subjective valuation of the hana that the Baal HaSadeh receives. And that's pretty well established. You can see that this is the Beis Yosef citing that psak of the Ran. What I thought is really cool is the Mordechai. Anybody see the Mordechai? This is great.
Right. I thought the Mordechai was a more like mochrach and precise extension from the Gemara.
More precise, yeah, because it's not. Go ahead. So let's.
In the last line. So Parakat Yishnaflu Mashma Hechad Isle Labal Hasada Man De Tarach Bechinam Lo Yahiv Le Midi. So in a case of Yored, if the owner of the field would have had someone who would have worked for free, then the Baal HaSada owes the Yored nothing.
Yeah, this is great, right? Because this is saying that I think it's saying he receives no benefit from the Yored, given that he had somebody who could do it for free for him.
Yeah,
right. So this is like the Baal HaBatim in Englewood, you know, when they get obsessed with Yored. So they say, what do you mean? A guy comes and shovels my yard. I already pay a guy at the beginning of the year that if it snows, he's going to show up. So I gain nothing if the Yored, you know, shovels my walk because my guy with the tractor was going to come a few hours later anyway. You know, that kind of a case.
I think the Mordechai is importing the principle from Zenen Evzeinu Chaser.
I mean, that there's no, well, maybe, but isn't it just a cleaner point that there's no benefit?
No, intuitively there, I mean, like the Gemaras are obvious, but in Zena, the Gemaras are in Baba Basra about Zena and Zena Chasa are clear. I think they're very counterintuitive conceptually.
Meaning like Zachariah was talking about, is he a Gavra, David, Lemegar?
Exactly. So if you could have had somebody, well, the point in fact, well, you know, very nice, sir, that you could have had somebody else do it for free, but I did it. So you are, in fact, a benefit was conferred. It's interesting that in your particular case, so is a benefit or is a benefit the saving from a loss that you would have otherwise incurred? So where there's no loss, there's no benefit. I don't know. It just seems like a kind of using your left hand to scratch your right ear way of defining benefit, I gotta tell you.
Fair.
The Gemara defines it that way. So
I didn't say that what I'm saying is consistent with the Gemara. I'm saying that I think The Mordechai said what I said at the beginning. I take back nothing and I add nothing. The Mordechai is importing the principle that he learned from the Sugya and Baba Basra about Zen and Zeno Chaser. It's a counterintuitive principle.
Yeah, I don't know if it's so counterintuitive. I think it's like in a case where somebody's been benefiting me in a way that I wouldn't have had to pay it at all. Sort of like somebody invites me for Shabbos lunch, you know, it's whatever. Like I don't need to make Shabbos lunches if there's a kiddush at shul and it's a waste for me to spend the money. You know, it's not a monetary increase to me.
We can play this intuition game all day and use all the synonyms we want. I'm very comfortable that my understanding of benefit is the intuitive one. I also know what the text says. But yeah, anyway.
Right. I mean, the question is, I guess the debate here is the benefit the fact that you receive the service, it's valuable, right? Or is the point that given the counterfactual world where the thing is provided for free or satisfied in any event, this guy's service has no value to you. That's the, what is that, the tension here?
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, the Mordechai, I think the Mordechai is straightforward. Right? He's just saying that if you had the option to do it for free, that your hana benefit is zero. So you're not obligated to pay the yorid anything.
That's not true. I mean, you just made an illicit inference. Whatever. The Mordechai is using the Gemara's principle. I don't resent him for it.
All right. Good. Yeah, all right. Good. And you can see here the Pesachei Choshen has an interesting comment. When he cites this din, you evaluate how much benefit. He says, Kisha Shaman Liyorid, how it so is Vishar Tircho. That was like the Ran citing the Rashba. Here adds, the idea being that if, like, you know, you're antsy to do more work and the Yorei deprives you of the work, then you don't pay him anything. So that becomes like a Mordechai's case of doing it bechinam because you receive no benefit from the service that he provided, given your desire to do it on your own. Zecharia, you have a hand?
Yeah, like the Gemara of Achushe Mechoza, like literally someone who's like antsy or like he's like a strict exercise regime. So like he has to keep working. No one ever wondering if this also is true economically. Like what if someone simply can't afford to be Yoshev Batel, and then someone jumps the gun and does his job for him. And it's like, oh, you're so lucky. I was Mahana you and gave you a vacation. But
see, this is a difficult question in the Chushe de Machoza Poel Batel Sugya also, because, you know, what if the guy needs the money? So for that reason, he'd rather work than take the vacation time. Right? Does that put him in the category of a Chushe de Machoza, or does it have to be something more that like, he enjoys what he's doing more. People differ on this. People have different intuitions about what the underlying principle there is. And I think you could have different intuitions in our case also about whether like the financial stress makes it the case that you have no benefit from the service, right? See, my initial reading of the Chaznish that we had started with is conciliatory to the idea that financial stress is the same as a Chushe de Mechoza. Because it's just an assessment question of how much would you pay to not have to do it yourself? If the answer is zero, given whatever background considerations, whether that's what you enjoy doing or what your financial burdens are, then that means that you receive no benefit from the service. That's my intuition. And I think the same thing is true in Achushi de Mechoza, right? When Rashi says, Umdin kama adam rotza l'shalem leishe batel, if the guy would pay $0 leishe batel, for whatever reason, he wants to keep up his skills, he likes working out, he wants to make the money, right? Then that means that the amount he would pay leishe batel is just zero. Cool. Cole, do you have a thought? It looks like you're poised to say something.
Nope.
Okay, good. Good. Well,
the Peace Guy Coalition really does yeoman's work on this Sugya.
Yeah. You're saying that sarcastically or?
No. I'm completely serious. He's a perspicuous collator and a perspicacious analyst.
Yeah, I agree.
He also has this nice line about the Kafadimyon that
yes,
I read that. I was Talmidim of Yeshivat Haaretzion are
Kiyorid. Yeah, he's right. Yeah. Like, he has this thing. Oh, if it's Kiyorid, then there's no case of Yorid. Like, what's the paradigm case? All cases are just
your quality.
That's right. Okay, so I want to now move to a related question, though I think conceptually slightly distinct from the question we've just been asking. Yeah, until now, our inquiry focused on the subjective nohana of the Balakarga. In this little section, I want to know, what happens if the Balabayas is mocha prior to the yored conferring the benefit? In the earlier discussion, it's this ex post facto bidyeved litigation about did the Bala Bias benefit from the service. Let's put that question on hold now and ask a related but I think distinct question. Let's say regardless of whether the Bala Bias received some benefit, suppose he put up a sign saying no improvements wanted here, like a no trespassing sign, no yored improvements desired. Is that kind of a macha enough to vitiate the yored's claim for compensation? So it's actually not clear in the Gemara. The Gemara doesn't take a stand on this. And by the way, it's interesting. It's an interesting property question because the question is, does the Bala Bias, how vulnerable is the Bala Bias? Right? Meaning, if, to use the Hofeldian term, what kind of a Hofeldian immunity does the Bala Bias have? Sorry, not immunity. What kind of Hofeldian liability does the Bala Bias have? Remember, a liability is that somebody else has a power to change your legal situation. So like in the honorary piece, if the government has a power of eminent domain, then you have a liability to be subject to their power, right? They could the government could change your property right by taking away your property. So what liability does each person have to be subject to a yored's changes? And can they do anything to immunize themselves from the yored's incursion? Right? Could they do anything to make themselves immune from being subject to the yored changing their legal situation? So this comes out of a discussion in Bava Basra on Dalet Amud Beis. Very exciting, because this is apparently why I use Limud for next year. So really great Limud at the beginning of Bava Basra. So the Mishnah there talks about this case. Long debate between all the Rishonim weigh in on this discussion on Dalet Amud Beis. Anybody just want to tell us the part that's important for us? Anybody get a chance to see this Makif and Nikaf discussion?
No. Yeah, the if you're like neighbors with a guy and you know for whatever reason, like you build a fence around his property that is only three sides, then there's no claim against him for comp. This is Hilchos Shcheinim, not Hilchos Shutfin, by the way. But if he adds a fourth side, then, you know.
Well, it's machlokas, right? If he has to add the fourth side or not, you can see it's, if there are three walls that are built, then, so it sounds like there are different ways of understanding the case in that sugya. But if three walls are built such that it doesn't really benefit the other fellow, then he's not liable to chip into your wall building. But if somehow either he builds the fourth wall or you build a fourth wall, such that now the walls that you build for your property help his property also, he's protected from trespassers, he's protected from animals, whatever the issue there is, Mahomes has shown him, if somehow he now benefits by your construction of the fourth wall, Megalodon all of Esakol, he now has a duty to chip in for the costs of the wall building because he's a beneficiary. Is that clear to everybody? Everybody on board with this? Okay. Now, here's the interesting part. I think Mara says, Loshna Amai Makif, Loshna Amai Nika, right? It's, it doesn't matter who built the fourth wall. The fact is, once the fourth wall is built, he's benefiting in a way that obligates him to pay compensation. Okay, so the Ramban here weighs in, and he's concerned that, kind of like we saw in the Chazanish, he's concerned that you could just go around forcing benefits on other people. Like it just seems to undermine like the reason for property, that people could control their stuff and not be subject to other people's wants, not have costs imposed upon them. So Ramban says, "V'adayin yesh adakti, kivan she'eino yachol lachofo l'sayeya imo ligdor, lama megalgin olav achsha." If you can't compel the guy to receive the wall, I can't force you to, as my neighbor, to build a wall. How could you be forced to build the cost? How could you be forced to shoulder some of the cost if I build it for myself? It says, like, why should the neighbor be forced to absorb the cost of a wall that you built? How could you impose that on him? So, like, you can't lechatchila say, hey, neighbor, you have a duty to build a wall here. But if you build a wall, then b'diavad, you could force him to pay half the costs. And the Ramban thinks that's very strange, right? Like, why, how could you force the costs on him? So the Ramban here says, this is a big chiddush, actually, but kind of obvious. Ulodidi lo kashya, sheharei ze dome b'miktsas, l'yorei l'toch sdei chavero b'nata shelo b'rishus. She'ilu mitchila ba limlech, Michal Yado, Eino Rashai Ligaba. He says, the Efshar, interesting that the Ramban qualifies the Efshar, She'eino Chayev Lo Klum. The Ramban says, it sounds like in the Yorid case, the whole discussion is Bidiyeved. He planted the stuff. We don't know what the Balabayas' desires were, L'chadchila, so he's got to pay for the benefit. But had the Bala Bayis had been consulted by the Yorid, and he was Mochad, the Bala Bayis said, I don't want any improvements here, the Yorid is not allowed to trespass. And moreover, the Ramban says with the Efshar, Eino Chayev Liten Lo Klum. You're not, you have no duty to compensate the Yorid for the benefit that he conferred. El Adraba, the Yorid would take back his Avanim, and the Yorid would have to pay for the harm to the Karka. Afilu b'sadeh ha'asuy alita, even in a sadeh which is otherwise omeid l'netios. But if you weren't moche, the amad me'atzmo v'nata, shaman lo b'yado ha'alyona. What the Ramban here is trying to point out is that in ex ante macha makes all the difference in the world for a yored case. If you're moche in advance, you put up a sign saying no yoreds, no yoreds wanted here, then you're exempt from having to pay compensation to the yored. It's pretty fascinating. What do you think? Make sense? Yeah, I think it's pretty good. I think it makes a lot of sense. I think it makes a lot of sense.
Limit to the kind of teleological. So there are... You can imagine a world without, let's just, what's the possible world? You could imagine a world without Yored. You can imagine a world where the only thing that mattered in assigning liability or in assigning an obligation to compensate is the consent to the, is a contract. So Yored is the chiddush, so you don't need a contract to get comp out of somebody. All you need is the conferral of a benefit. But there's a limit to that principle because, nichale is decisive or is preemptive.
Interesting question whether mocha is a nichale issue or...
I meant nichale kind of broadly, like you're...
Or a distinct issue that you still get to control your property.
Right,
your expressed desire, one way or the other, is your demonstrated desire is decisive.
That's right.
You know, Lakula and Lachumra, right?
This is why the Parat piece is interesting, because one of the points that he makes is that once you go through all the halachos, the systems may not be so different. It's just the default of the system is what's different, right? So in American law, by default, a yored is not entitled to anything. In halacha, by default, a yored is, but nothing bars the Baal HaBayis from opting out of yoreds by putting up a sign saying no improvements wanted here, which is, you know, not a big hassle. Then it becomes an interesting question. This harkens back to something we discussed right at the beginning of this Zman, which is, you know, what's the moral significance of how the defaults are set up? And we were talking about Minhag HaSochrim and that discussion, right? So, yeah, the Ramban's really good. Look here at the Rashba. I think the Rashba is saying the same thing. He quotes the Ramban. Just notice he takes out the word Efshar, and the Ramban seems to hedge about whether you're chayav to pay tashlum. Efshar shein chayav opum. The Rashba quotes the Ramban, and he says, V'tirat Ramban, and afkamina shem amar anika from micha b'makif, v'amar shelo ligdor machmaso, amenashe yeshalim lovid me'agdarim, or he's a potter. So the Rashba is unequivocal that a macha works. About kolzman shalom yichabo v'amar v'geder chayev. The havel ikiyored letok stei chaver v'nata shalom bershos. She'im yichabo baal hasada are hanoteya hifsid legamri. So you see the Rashba is unequivocal that a macha would cause the yored a loss. Yeah, which is like a slight modification on the Ramban's view. Okay, everyone okay with these Ramban and Rashba discussion? Yeah, okay. I want to bring to your attention two other sources here. Do we lose Evan? Evan, you with us?
Ah, I'm here.
Here he is. Is this like lunch or something? Or
I honestly must have clicked it accidentally. I didn't realize my camera was off.
Way to go, way to go. All right, good to see you though. It's all good. Missed you. That's the problem. All right, so the Rashba in this tshuva and in this other tshuva, I think, adds a little bit of a wrinkle to this discussion. Anybody get a chance to see Dalid and Dalid? Okay, so great tshuva, Sir Rashba. Really just brings the question right to a head. So Sha'alta. I think when Chaim Soloveitchik once told us that he remembers Rav Lichtenstein telling him that he would be embarrassed to be the shoel in like half the Tshuva Sarashbas. Because like it's like basic, it's like half the shilas are just like basic Gemara questions. You know, it's like, what's the din? And it's like, oh, anybody who opened the Mishnah would know the din. It was like the Rashba was like answering like a lot of basic questions, like almost like a communal Rav, you know. But this is not that kind of a tshuva. Here it's actually just a very, right here it's like a conceptually interesting, non-trivial question that's posed. Sha'alta, mi shehisra b'chaveru shalol yered l'toch sedeyu shalol lasos b'hotza b'netiyos b'zulasan. So you explicitly warn somebody not to make improvements. V'lo shama v'halach v'hotzi v'hishbiach. And the guy disobeyed and did it anyway. Mahu she yischai b'schar amlo b'hotza. Also, mi have k'din yored l'toch stei chaveru shalol b'rshos alo. Really just brings the lundish question to, it's a well-posed question. Does yored apply in a case where there's an advanced macha? So he discusses our Gemara. He cites the case where the guy, Rav's story, where the fellow said lo ba'ina, and amar le lo ba'ina. And he says, Alma, it's pretty interesting. This is not an obvious diak from our Gemara. Alma ad chaza demintarle, until Rav saw the fellow guard it, havale mashma de lo lechaive klum. Maybe this is because the second lobeina and like Rav never responds. If the guy really didn't want the improvement at all, maybe he's not chai of anything. This harkens back to the beginning of our discussion today, right? If he didn't want it subjectively, then there's no liability. V'kivan shekein kol shekein b'shahalach zevin not the achar shehitzer v'bala sadeh. All the more so if there's like an explicit hasra. Now, you might say that these are two separate points, by the way. One question is whether you got hana, and there's going to be one rule for hana. A separate question is, do you as a bailim have the authority, I guess what Larissa Katz calls, do you have agenda setting authority over your property? Meaning, right, regardless of whether you benefited, do you as the owner have the final say on what's done with your stuff? See, the Rashba seems to merge these two together because he says, if you could argue that you don't get, you, that it was lo nicha lecha and you got no hana, kol shekein amacha in advance would work. But look at the rationale for that kol shekein. He says, shelo yehe kolachan machriach lechavero lintos velivnos. See, that sounds like agenda setting authority as a property owner, right? It's almost like the Chazanish, laksa midas adin, or maybe the Chazanish is a little different because that's about the irony point about the undermining, the yoreds undermining the benefit. But this sounds more like a property rule that owners should have a certain security and agenda setting authority with what happens to their property. You might think that that's totally separate from the question of, well, look, the yored has to confer a benefit in order to be entitled to compensation. See, and then the Rashba actually says, "Mihu imr inu oso la'achar mikan sheshomer pardeso nichnas beveso v'daro b'chayven oso." This is strange. He says, even in a case where there was an advanced macha, if it turns out that you did benefit from it, as evidenced by your using it and you know, guarding the benefit that you receive, then you're going to be chayef to pay yadu al yona. So there are a few points here, right? So one is that he says a macha does work. The second point is that he grounds that in the agenda setting authority of a balakarka. But then he seems to say that a gilui das, that you like the benefit, would undermine the macha, the force of the macha that you made in advance. Which to my mind is not trivial, right? You might think that a macha in advance entitles you to whatever appreciation the guy did in your karka because he has no right to retain it after you told him not to do it. Let me hear your thoughts on this Rashba here. Anyone have thoughts on this? Noah, you have a hand up. I think that's all from before, right?
Yeah, it's from the Babasra Dalit.
We'll go back to Babasra Dalit in 1 second. Do you have thoughts? Anybody have thoughts on this Rashba? Really great Rashba. It's an interesting question on how to balance these different considerations. Cole, do you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm trying to... I mean... I don't see any reason why you why the protest. I don't. Whatever the Rashba says, it's pretty clear what the Rashba says. I'm trying to think whether I agree that the protest should be kind of decisive in terms of absolving the balabais of an obligation to compensate the yored, or whether I think you can. It's obvious that the post facto. Manifestation of, you know, agreement should be retrojected. I really should learn how to speak simpler English.
Evan is in assent on that.
On that last point, yeah. I apologize. That was. It's funny. I you know, it's like what Churchill said. I'm sorry that I gave a long speech. I didn't have time to prepare a short one. It's a sign of somebody with too much education and too little like life experience. Anyway, I think I might sort of be sympathetic to what Itamar said, and but I would have said what the Rashba said, which is that it's possible to withdraw a protest. Not that you didn't mean it, just that, like, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Let me motivate. I think I can motivate this a little further. And then I'll take Zachariah's hand. Notice in a lot of these Rishonim, they say that, you know, this, like in that Ramban, They associate this with Tol Eitz Chava Vanecha. Right, so you can see here, the Ramban said, She'ilu mitchila ba limlechu micha, eino rasha liga ba, veino chayv lo plum, ele yitol Eitz Chava Vanav. V'yishalim kechesh karka oshel zeh. The Yori takes back his stuff, and he just pays the damages. It's not a big deal, but just notice that the Ramban thinks that the Yori is entitled to undo the benefit that he conferred. That's not a trivial conclusion. You might think the Yoreid actually has to forfeit the materials and the thing that he constructed through his trespass, which was clearly wrongful, right? The Baal HaBayis, you know, said, don't do it. If you look at the Red, but if you look at the Ramban and the Rashba, they all seem to assume that the Yoreid could recover these things. You could see, Hanahariya Notea Hifsid Lagamri. And Michalo Bala Sade Harian Otea Hifsi Lugamri Bala Sade Omer Lo Tol Eitz Chava Vanecha. If you look at the Radvaz, who has a similar discussion, did you guys see this Tshuva of the Radvaz yet? Okay, so yeah, Noah or Zachariah, you want to tell us about the Tshuva of the Radvaz? I think he comes to a different conclusion. I don't know if you noticed this point. Did you notice this point? Okay, so Noah, I think Zachariah is deferring to you.
Yeah, so he like starts off with this like nice question, the Rambam. And then he basically says that here the Mistabra. So his Mistabra is that if you're Masra from the beginning, then you actually can't. The Yori can't take back his stuff. Baal HaBayis gets the ability to keep the keep the Eitzim Vavanim.
Exactly. He says. Im hisra bo shelo yivna, so exactly the Ramban and the Rashba's case, ubana, afilu amar etzai va'avane ani notel in shalim lo. The Yoreid forfeits his claim even to his to recover his materials. Shalmin nas kein yarad ubana. Sounds like, you know, the way Porat would put it in his
donative.
Exactly. It's just like we're gonna posit donative intents, right? He's a volunteer, right? I told you not to do it. You did it anyway. So it's like, we're going to interpret this as a voluntary conferral of a benefit, which means that the Yoreid forfeits his materials. It's interesting that the Rashba and the Ramban don't buy that, right? Notice he also says, the lav kol kamine lachav es chavera bal karcho. See, that is a slightly different rationale than the Rashba. You want to tell us, Noah, why it's a different rationale? I saw you're nodding from the Rashba.
I was thinking like it's a different rationale than the donative like intent.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Yeah, so it's sort of like, you know,
you're saying there's like, yeah, well, let me hold off on that. I think there are two separate points.
Yeah. What were you going to say?
Yes, what I was going to say, I just think that this rationale on the Rashba of the agenda setting authority, to me, that's more of a substantive claim about property. I could send around this interesting article by Larissa Katz about, she thinks property is about having the agenda setting authority. You know, so what it means to be a Bala Karka is that nobody could tell you what you should do with your Karka. That's different, I think, from the Radvaz, which seems to be that nobody could impose costs on you that are to your detriment. I can impose costs that confer a benefit, right? So I can impose a benefit on you that you have to pay for, but nobody could impose a net cost on somebody bal karcho. To me, those are two separate ideas. I could see how in certain cases they'll come together. Okay, cool, yeah. I see this is part of your task to attempt to speak simpler. Interesting point. But I think these two, the rationale of the Radvaz and the rationale of the Rashba, come apart. Does that make sense to you guys? Are there slightly different points? Okay. Then I think Noah's making the further point that within the Radvaz, there's kind of this tension of Amanas Kein Yarad Ubana, volunteer donative intent, which is really distinct from this rationale. I mean, this is the reason why he's not going to be entitled to any compensation. Although it doesn't explain why he should have to forfeit his Eitzim Va'avanim, which I think Noah was getting at just now. So Noah, you have a hand on this.
Yeah, so when Z and I were reading this, I think we noted the tension in within the red bars. I think now that I'm looking at it, I think it's a little bit more, it fits together a little bit more in the sense that sort of maybe read the second part of the phrase as like the reason for the donative intent is sort of once the Balasada is Masra, then it becomes Bal Korcho to be Mechayiv him, and thus you know, it's the Yorid assuming risk, sort of like putting his eggs in the, I don't know, wherever you put eggs, and then hoping they hatch, and then, you know, but they don't need to hatch, I guess.
Yeah, I hear that. It's a nice way of reading their advice. Yeah, I like that a lot. I would say, see, this question of whether the Yorid forfeits his materials is just really, it intrigues me. Because if the issue is just lo nichale, I think is what Noah's getting at. If the issue is just lo nichale, no hana, it's not obvious that the Yorid should have to forfeit the materials, right? That's what the Ramban said. You just put the Bala Bias back into the position he was in before the Yorid got there. So what do you do? The Ramban said, give him back his materials, and the Yorid pays like whatever it costs to put the Karka back into its position that it was in before he came. So, you know, reset the Bala Bias so that he's not at a net loss. So that seems to be a direct consideration of, we want to make sure the Bala Bias is not losing by the Yorid's actions. And I think that's consistent with viewing Yorid through the lens of Nene, you know, or Nene versus Chov. The Radvaz seems to be going further, and he seems to think that there's something stronger about Nichale. There's something stronger about Macha. Once you're Moche, then that, as you say, that makes it like Bal Karcho Shel Bala Bayis, and you can't force things on the Bala Bayis Bal Karcho, which I think might be a stronger mm-hmm. principle. Even though the point about Lachov is slightly in tension with that, but the agenda setting authority principle, I think, makes a lot of sense that the Yorid would have to forfeit his materials. All right, I think we should stop here. I say for Thursday, we should just, I'll talk about the Yad Arma very briefly. The Yad Arma is just another version of this Lo Nichale Macha discussion that we just covered. But let's maybe just talk about the Porat article. And I'll send out maybe one other short article on Yorid from Weinreb, which might be interesting to look at. And then we'll be in the clear to start Shomrim on Tuesday. I'm going to send out, just let me just tell you, there's, I'll PDF this. Rav Lichtenstein has Shiurim on HaShoel. I don't know if anybody's seen the one of those blue books. He has a nice intro to Shomrim, which I think will help lay some of the groundwork for us. So definitely prepare the Mishnah and Sadi Gimel Aleph at the bottom and like the first blot there. And then I'll also send around that Rav Lichtenstein introduction to Chiyuv Shomrim. I think it's just he's a nice introduction that we could build up. So that'll be the plan for the coming Tuesday. All right, everyone. I'm very pumped for Shomrim. It's really is great material there. I started preparing a little bit. Solid, really good stuff. So we should all be excited for this new Limud coming up. I know Cole's been looking forward to it for a while. All right, Shkayach, everyone.
If you say we learn Hashutfin next year, since we're only going to start in January, can we do Shabbos for the first half of the year? Or is it okay? No, just like.
All right, let me think about that, Cole.
Give it some thought. Itamar, stay on for a sec, okay? I just want to talk to you about that.
Okay, one second. Good. All right, Shkayach, everyone.